What is this? A phone. You say, I mean, we say this is a phone, right? With this device that we typically call a phone, I can ruin my life in 15 minutes flat. I can ruin my relationships. I can gossip. I can slander. I can lie. I can boast. I can become narcissistic. I may ruin my finances, gamble, risk in the markets, purchase anything, anytime. I might choose to ruin my reputation by posting or tweeting or commenting. I could lose my job as a pastor by online choices I'm making. I could ruin my marriage. I could secretly have an affair. I may choose to lust after thousands of women or men. I can anonymously take advantage of and abuse children. As an adolescent or a minor, I could produce child pornography by taking pictures of myself and distributing it to my friends and even predators. As an adolescent, I might privately in my room late at night explore my quest for answers about my gender or my same-sex feelings that I don't want to talk about at the church, and I will find a welcoming community that will accept me just the way I am. I can ruin my faith by reading endless blogs and posts containing attractive heresy, self-help theology, prosperity, New Age philosophy. This is no phone, okay? You can make a phone call, but this is not a rotary phone. With this, how see how thin that is? Little light thing. I can ruin my life. And I forgot to mention, I could ruin yours almost just as easily. This phone is what most parents are giving their kids with well-intentioned desire to keep in touch, right? But we need help understanding the depth of the consequences that are being experienced among children as well as adults when it comes to particularly the smartphone phenomenon. I want to read you a quote from a book that's on your table called The TechWise Family by Andy Crouch. This is the introduction. It's a good place to start in a book. This is driving me nuts. Don't let it drive you nuts, too. The microphone, that is. He says this: if there's one word that sums up how many of us feel about technology and family life, the intersection, it's help. Parents know we need help. We love the way devices make our lives easier amid the stress and busyness that fill our days. We love the way screens can almost magically absorb our children's attention and give us a few moments of quiet in the car or before dinner. We admire the ease with which our children master technology and the prowess they show with video games, the bursts of creativity in the arts, movies, and music that devices help them produce. But we also sense the precious days of childhood are passing by far too fast in a haze of ghostly blue or green light. We watch as the inevitable intensity of teenage relationships is raised to near toxic levels by a sleep-depriving, round-the-clock deluge of messages, and we feel helpless to prevent them from overexposure to some of the most violent and intimate acts of life. Parents feel out of control, overmatched by the deluge of devices. And kids know that we need help too. A quick disclaimer that even as you hear everything I say, I am not anti-technology. The church is not to be anti-technology. Tech helped us get us here this morning. There were emails that were sent out, things that were printed on machines. I made a few different phone calls, computers, printers, video projectors, and coffee makers allowed us to be here this morning. Technology is not evil, but my hope this morning is to broaden the perspective that we have, really to help you open your eyes. I'm going to say some provocative things. If you leave here disagreeing with everything I say but are challenged to look into it more, I'm okay with that. I want to point you to some resources. And as Lisa said, I want to help you connect with one another because you share the same concerns. We're on the same team. Quick overview of how this is going to work. I'm going to share a little bit, and then I'm going to show you a brief video clip, which is a resource that I think would be worthy of pursuing more than what you're going to see today. And then you'll have just a couple minutes to talk about it at your tables, and then we'll repeat that again. So that'll happen three times. The focus of our attention is on the iGen. That's the name for the generation that was born after 1995 officially, but specifically those who are born after 2000. So if you have children that were born after the year 2000 up until currently, they're part of the iGen. This is a demographic who has grown up with the iPhone and the iPad. The iPhone was created in 2007. Think about that for a second. 2007. Easy for me to think that this has always been a part of our life, but it's just turning 11. As far as technology goes, and any research, 11 years in means we're guinea pigs, lab rats at this point. According to a 2016 study from the research firm Influence Control, the average age for a child getting his or her first smartphone right now in the United States is 10.3 years old. That's the average. You know how averages work. That means some kids are getting them much earlier while other parents are delaying. In 2015, 73% of teens had access to a smartphone. That was 3 years ago. So we began by asking the question, what effects do these devices and computers have on our culture and our kids? And I'm just going to say the statistics and all that is written on this subject right now primarily does not bring us any good news. There is some positives, but really not much to report. And so this is a hard conversation. It's why we're here having this conversation. If we didn't struggle with it, we wouldn't have the felt need. Mood disorders, aggression, depression, and psychosis are all on the rise with current teens today. Psychology Today magazine reports there's an 800% increase in ADHD diagnoses over the past 30 years. Not 80%, 800%. Teen suicide, which is quite popular right now in the news, it's getting more attention, which is good. It's increased 23% in the last 8 years. 23%. That's the iGen. Of those attempts, the teens who were successful in taking their own lives, so not just an attempt, which is a cry for help, but the teen who actually succeeds in taking their life, which is usually very rare that that actually happens, has increased 31%. In South Korea, we're excited for the Olympics, South Korea, they have, due to their felt need, opened over 400 storefronts that are technology rehab facilities. China just recently identified tech addiction as one of their primary health concerns for their human population. A few weeks ago in Bloomberg, they reported that two major Apple shareholders, people who have the ability to leverage the company of Apple, wrote an open letter to Apple pushing for the study of the effects of the devices that Apple was producing on culture, particularly young people, and the potential for addiction. It seems like every week, just in the last few months, there's a new article, new research coming forward, new voices, 90% are all secular and do not believe in the wisdom of the scriptures, saying we have a problem. I want to read a quote to you. It says, Americans no longer talk to each other. They entertain each other. They do not exchange ideas. They exchange images. They do not argue with propositions. They argue with good looks, celebrities, and commercials. Any of you heard of the book Amusing Ourselves to Death? That quote was written in 1984. Neil Postman has been somewhat of a prophet in this area. He saw it coming many years prior, and it's true today. Barna Research, which is good and bad as an organization, but recently has shown that 65% of parents of those in the iGen, which is most of us in this room, would agree that technology and social media have made parenting more difficult. Okay, it's like, why? It's kind of why you want to hear about this right now. We've agreed to that. So I want to just ask you guys the question that's behind me on the screen here. Why or in what ways has tech made parenting more difficult? Would you just throw out a few? Well, that's the question. Don't worry about if it's up there or not. Why has it made it harder as a parent to have technology and social media around? Excellent. So it becomes an obsession, and we're going to talk more about obsession and addiction and why it's so surprising to us that this is happening. Other reasons why technology has made parenting more difficult. You can have a secret life and hide things, which because of our sin nature, we are inclined to hide. We don't hide good things. Sometimes we bury treasure, but typically we want to hide our sin. So as we start to address this issue, we really need to think rightly about it. And I want us to read, or I'll read to you Proverbs 8, because we as parents, scriptures don't speak of iPhones, but the scriptures speak of wisdom. And the types of decisions we're making when it comes to technology are wisdom decisions. Proverbs 8, 1 through 5 says, "Does not wisdom call? Does not understanding raise her voice on the heights beside the way? At the crossroads she takes her stand. Besides the gates in front of the town, at the entrance of the portals she cries aloud. To you, O men, I call, and my cry is to the children of a man. O simple ones, learn prudence. O fools, learn sense." So I hear that. The word is calling me to learn prudence and to learn sense. What does it mean for us to have right sense when it comes to technology? You know, it's been said that technology is a tool. Anybody heard that phrase before? Technology is a tool. By that, it's kind of like a pocket knife. I've got my handy dandy Swiss Army knife right here. So you can, they sell these for kids, you know, so they can open up their wine bottles. Got all these different devices. It's a tool. You know, a knife is made for cutting something. And I recently heard a Christian psychologist say that parents are more careful about giving their child a knife than they might be when they think about giving their child a smartphone. And I think it's worthy to consider why we might do that. Some of your children may have access to a smartphone, but you've yet to let them wield one of these. But I think we're missing the point. Technology, let me back up. A tool is passive. Okay? A tool is neutral. This knife has no agenda. It was created for a task, right? Lots of tasks. And I can choose as the user to use it for a task other than it was created. I could take this knife and start to clean my fingernails, right? That might be a little dangerous. Or if I wanted to clean out my ears, that might be a bad choice of how to use this tool. But the tool is not demanding that I use it in any certain way. But many of our current technologies, particularly the ones that are on a cell phone, are not tools. Social media, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, YouTube, those are the primary ones that the youth culture is involved with now, and us. They're designed with a daily agenda. Now, the flashlight on your smartphone is a tool. The calculator on your smartphone is a tool. The calendar, a tool. Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, not tools, not neutral, designed daily with a fluid design process that's always changing with a purpose. The first resource I want to introduce you to, I'm going to throw up a video here in a second. It's a guy named Tristan Harris. So Tristan Harris he graduated from Stanford University as a student. He worked for Google as an ethicist for Google. Google does have ethicists. And he would say if you have ethics and you work for Google in his job, it required him resigning. So Tristan resigns from Google and launches two new nonprofits, or probably one's a profit, one's a nonprofit, Common Sense Media and the Center for Humane Technology. And he is not a believer, but I want you to hear just 2 minutes of what he has to say.
I want you to imagine walking into a room, control room, with a bunch of people, 100 people, hunched over at desks with little dials, and that control room will shape the thoughts and feelings of a billion people. This might sound like science fiction, but this actually exists right now, today. I know because I used to be in one of those control rooms. I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts. Because what we don't talk about is a handful of people working at a handful of technology companies, through their choices, will steer what a billion people are thinking today. Because when you pull out your phone and they design how this works or what's on the feed, it's scheduling little blocks of time in our minds. If you see a notification, it schedules you to have thoughts that maybe you didn't intend to have. If you swipe over that notification, it schedules you into spending a little bit of time getting sucked into something that maybe you didn't intend to get sucked into. When we talk about technology, we tend to talk about it as this blue sky opportunity. It could go any direction. And I want to get serious for a moment and tell you why it's going in a very specific direction. Because it's not evolving randomly. There's a hidden goal driving the direction of all of the technology we make. And that goal is the race for our attention. Because every news site, TED, elections, politicians, games, even meditation apps have to compete for one thing, which is our attention. And there's only so much of it. And the best way to get people's attention is to know how someone's mind works. And there's a whole bunch of persuasive techniques that I learned in college at a lab called the Persuasive Technology Lab to get people's attention.
The race for our attention. I want you guys at your tables to answer this question with one another. Because, and I'm guilty of this as well. And the question is, in what ways have you been maybe naive? And if that's feeling too judgmental, in what ways maybe have you not thought well about technology being something other than passive? And what are the consequences on your family? So just take like 3 minutes to answer that question. In what ways maybe have you been naive in the past to think of social media as neutral? And how has it affected your family to have it in your home? Go ahead and discuss that. It's an interesting idea to think that a handful of folks in Silicon Valley are thinking today about what over a billion people will consider in front of them tomorrow. Never have such a small group of people, such a narrow niche of folks, primarily under the age of 35, had so much power in a culture. I'm going to read you another quote. It says this, "But it is much later in the game now, and ignorance of the score is inexcusable. To be unaware that a technology comes equipped with a program for social change, to maintain that technology is neutral, to make the assumption that technology is always a friend to culture, is at this late hour stupidly plain and simple." Once again, that was written in 1984 by Neil Postman. Dr. Peter Weibrow is UCLA's director of the Institute of Neuroscience and Human Behavior. He's called the computer and computer games, and he said this actually maybe 5 or 7 years ago before the impacts of the iPhone had really come out. He's called computer and computer games electronic cocaine with similarly addictive qualities. And a lot's been written on how social media and video games and even educational games are designed very purposefully with strategic dopamine releases as the user interacts with the game. They're trying to maximize intellectual arousal and attention in order to retain the user as long as possible. So no longer are games, I think the idea, the thinking, the philosophy behind game making has progressed a long way since you and I were playing some of the simple games in our youth. The types of technology that we're talking about today, particularly the ones that are going to end up on our children's devices, are not tools to be used. They are seeing the user as the tool. The New York Times had an article come out, in October 23rd in 2011, so this is a little while back. This is the year after the iPad came out. It says, in Los Altos, California, the chief technology officer of eBay sends his children to a 9-classroom school here. So do employees of Silicon Valley giants like Google, Apple, Yahoo, and Hewlett-Packard. The school's chief teaching tools are anything but high-tech, pens and paper, knitting needles, and occasionally mud. Not a computer to be found. No screens at all. They're not allowed in the classroom, and the school even frowns on their extended use at home. Schools nationwide have rushed to supply their classrooms with computers, and many policymakers say it's foolish to do otherwise. But the contrarian point of view can be found at the epicenter of the tech economy, where some parents and educators have a message: computers in schools don't mix. Alan Eagle, who is a Google exec with a computer science degree from Dartmouth, says, I fundamentally reject the notion that you need technology aids in grammar school. It's interesting. But technology in the classroom currently is estimated a $60 billion business. It's not going anywhere. And I'm not saying that private schools or low-tech schools are the only option for kids, but I think it's interesting to just hear that really smart people who work in the tech industry don't believe that their own products are necessary for education to go forward. Kids won't be left behind if they don't have access to a screen. We can take assurance in that. There is a lot that's written on technology and education. One resource I would point you to is this book here called Glow Kids. It's a research-based book that covers all sorts of subjects. If you got the guts to read it, read that one. I want to point you to another resource. Susie Cox is a professor of a secondary education at Utah Valley University. She has a doctoral degree in instructional psychology and technology. And she's going to talk for a few minutes. This is one of her TED Talks, so I'm just going to show you 2 minutes where she's talking about delayed adolescence and some of the unique challenges teens are facing because of the technology we have created for them. So she also is not a believer, but has some common grace wisdom for us. So listen to Susie Cox for a couple minutes.
So imagine walking around all day, every day, your head and body full of hormones, your emotions running amok with no guidance from the frontal lobes, firmly believing that no one in history has ever experienced what you experience. So you just have to fumble your way through. And everyone is watching you and judging you as you do it. Now pile on the countless expectations that we place on teenagers today. 8 different classes in which you must earn A's, weeks of standardized testing, and more extracurricular activities than ever before. Finally, let me clarify that very few people in this room fully understand what it is like to be a teenager in the digital age. I certainly don't. I may have believed that everybody was watching my mistakes, but it probably wasn't true. But today there's a cell phone in every pocket and myriad ways to upload video to the web in seconds. So that imaginary audience has become very real. And the rates of child and adolescent anxiety and depression are skyrocketing. This understanding of the reality of adolescence is staggering to me. I am honestly just so impressed that they can get out of bed in the morning. But I'm also beginning to realize how fully we are failing them. The brain is an amazingly adaptable organ that physically changes in response to what we ask it to do. Physically changes. Every new thing we learn, do, or experience changes the ways in which our brain cells interact and communicate with each other, effectively changing how we think and what we are capable of. So as we look at the life of a modern teenager, is it really any wonder that their development is delayed? What types of cognitive skills do standardized tests promote? What happens to a child's brain when she doesn't have time to engage in creative, unstructured outdoor play? And what is the impact of hours spent watching online videos or the constant stress that accompanies our always-on society? We have built this world, not them.
So that last statement is what I want us to think about for a second. We have built this world. And the question, I mean, I didn't build it, but in a sense, I have much more contribution to it than my child does. So one thing that I found surprising amongst parents when we wrestle with this issue of technology, there is very little sense of responsibility on behalf of the parent. Much more of a posture of, oh my goodness, I cannot believe this is happening to my child. What should I do? What can we do about this? I don't know. There's not any personal responsibility to the fact that that child is under their care and that child is living by their rules. Deuteronomy 4:9 says, only take care and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. Make them known to your children and your children's children. So at your tables, would you just discuss this question? I think it's kind of a big picture question. As you think about technology in your home and the hands of your children's lives, what does it look like for you as a parent to take responsibility? A while back, I sent out an email to many of the youth parents, so some of you would have gotten it. And in the email, there was a link to a CNN documentary called #being13. Does anyone here remember watching #being13? Just one, Megan.
All right.
Yeah, I'll send it out again. So this is a study that was done, I believe it was in 2012 or 2013. 13 sounds the right number, but it's being 13. I'll send that link out at the end to all of you guys later on. But in that... Yeah, you wouldn't want to necessarily watch it with your child. There's some vulgarities and sad things presented in the documentary. But one of the things I found most astonishing in it, so they brought in a group of kids, thousands, but then they brought a slice of that group into the studio. And they're talking with the children, and then they're talking about their online interactions and some of these horrific things that they've done or said or posted. And then they brought the parents in, a few parents, to dialogue in the presence of their child about what had been going on in their child's life. And the parents were shocked, disappointed, sad, frustrated, but never responsible. Never once did anyone ever suggest, maybe I shouldn't have given my child access to X, Y, or Z. So I pray that we as the church would not be guilty of shirking responsibility, that we would not be guilty of being intentionally ignorant, because it's so much easier not to know what's going on online, to the best of our ability. That's my hope for myself as a parent and also for you guys, that we would choose to engage when my natural inclination is to withdraw, that I would choose to restrict access, which is going to create conflict, where my natural inclination is to do something that's peaceable in the home. As we move forward, you know, the big question that many of you might be asking and you're hoping I'm going to answer and I might or may or may not answer is, when should I allow my child to have a device? You know, when's the right time to give a child access to a smartphone? When are they ready? I heard a thing on NPR a couple weeks back where they're dialoguing with an expert on this subject, and at the end of the show, the commentator was saying, so when should we give children devices. And he skirted the question because nobody wants to answer that question. And he said, no, so we got 10 seconds. When should we give children access to these devices? And he said, pause, the 10 seconds are counting down, you know. And he says, I think it would probably be inappropriate to give kindergartners access to these devices. and the commentator was kind of like, well, yeah, okay, whatever. We got to go. Da, 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 da. So kindergartners, maybe not. People are often shocked to find out that Steve Jobs, who was the inventor of the iPhone, managed the company of Apple for quite some time. Steve Jobs was a low-tech parent. Not only was he low-tech himself, because he grew up before tech, he created all computers, so he didn't have access to anything computer until he made it when he was a teenager, and he did quite well. But as a parent, he was low-tech as well. In 2010, which is the year the iPad was released, he was being interviewed with a reporter, and the reporter suggested that his children must love this new released iPad. Steve Jobs' reply was, well, they haven't used it. We limit how much technology our kids use at home, quote. So soak that in for a second. Take another second. Marinate in the fact that the person who best understands what the iPad and iPhone has to offer chose to not allow his children, particularly his youngest at that time, to utilize it. You want to know how old his youngest was in 2010? Aaron, his daughter. 15 years old. Do you think Steve Jobs was worried about how Erin would be perceived by her peers by withholding this technology from her? Sure he was. Can you imagine the conversation between Erin and her friends? Might go something like this. Hey, Erin, my dad bought me that sweet new iPad that your dad invented. My little sister has one too. I bet you have like three because your dad's awesome. To that, she would say, well, I don't have one. I'm not allowed. That, I tell you, was a tough parenting decision made by somebody who does not care for the wisdom of Proverbs 8, who does not feel the call to raise his children from Deuteronomy 4. It was motivated for him by the knowledge of what the device could do. And common grace. So when is a child ready for a smartphone? As these devices come off the shelf, you buy it from the store. When is somebody ready for this device? I would say never. You heard me correctly. I said never ready. Remember what we talked about, what this is capable of. Remember that right now we're in the test phase, the lab rat phase. The statistics for ADHD, social anxiety, addiction, depression, self-harm, eating disorders, suicide, cyberbullying, pornography, digital robbery, human trafficking, consensual prostitution, show that we are not ready for this device. And the device isn't the problem. It's quite pretty. Mine is white and silver. It has a flashlight. But the apps that are most commonly used are not written for human flourishing. As we've been told, they're written to market your attention. And I've been reminded about this sad reality that lab rats die. Tristan Harris, a non-believer, quit Google because of a moral conflict. Tristan Harris was being interviewed by Sam Harris. Sam Harris wrote a book called The Moral Landscape, which is an atheist argumentation of how we don't need Christians or the Bible to have ethics and morality and culture. So Tristan and Sam, two non-believers, are sitting around talking about the ethical dilemma of smartphones and the apps that are inside of them. Church, we need to be thinking about these things. Justin Rosenstein, co-founder of Asana. Asana is an app that helps you organize your life. That's actually a tool. He's also the inventor of the like button on Facebook. Justin Rosenstein has recently banned himself from Snapchat, which he compared to heroin. He has self-imposed limits on his use of Facebook. And he recently purchased a new iPhone. He was telling this in an interview that he took the iPhone and he gave it to his assistant and said, "Assistant, I would like you to set the parental controls that limit my interaction with this device and do not allow me to download apps unless you unlock my phone for me." That was reported in Guardian. Justin Rosenstein. So you understand what I said when I said children are not ready. No one is ready. That includes me. It includes Justin. It includes Tristan Harris. In order for me to even hold this device in a safe way to own this device, I had to do something to it, kind of like Justin, to make it not tempt me to destroy my life. So I made choices similar to these other people to employ filters. I use Covenant Eyes. My phone is locked out. My wife has the password in order to add or remove applications. There's no privacy on this phone. She has complete access to it. I need safeguards. We need safeguards. Our kids need all the more help navigating this. So you might be thinking, John, what are you suggesting? Are you saying I should say no to my child when they ask for a smartphone when they go into middle school in sixth grade, which is the trend in the Valley, if you haven't noticed yet, even earlier, third, fourth, and fifth, but six is like, of course, every sixth grader has a smartphone. Or are you suggesting that I say no to my child when they really want it, and they really, really want it, and they're having these emotional breakdowns in front of you, kind of like Lisa does better than I do, and they are saying, "You want me to die if you don't give me a smartphone in the ninth grade?" Let me illustrate it this way. Let's say your child's hungry, and they come to you and they would like some food. And you have a choice. You're kind of thinking, well, you know, I could go into the kitchen and I could pull out some ingredients. I could make some bread for my child. Simple. Say it's whole wheat. It's nourishing. Make some bread for my child. But you know, there's this buffet. The buffet that exists, that where the food there, I don't have to make it. It's made conveniently by somebody else who's gone through the trouble of purchasing all the ingredients and coming together and not just one option, but this smorgasbord of options to eat from. So when you look upon the buffet, it's enticing, and there's a lot of different options that are appealing to the eyes and to the senses, and you didn't have to do it. So you choose to take your child to the buffet. And as you send them up to the buffet line, you warn them that, well, real quick, before you go to the buffet, over half of the items on the buffet are laced with poison, okay? And it's you can't really tell which ones are which because it's inside. Some of them are just going to make you sick, so be careful. Other ones might lead to a premature death. So with that warning, you send them to make their selections. And as you stand by watching, you're kind of hoping for the best. You're not sensing any major responsibility, just anxiety. Smartphones are kind of like that buffet. If you give your kid a smartphone off the shelf and you don't do anything to it, you're basically saying, and it's half is really generous, half of the stuff you can do with this phone is helpful. And half of this stuff you can do with this phone will destroy your life. Figure it out. 30% of all Google searches are related to pornography. 30. Related to pornography, either a search that leads directly to pornography or a search trend where a child is wrestling, being a little tempted. I went here, then I went here, then I went here, and I ended up in pornography. And that's only Google. There's many other search engines, and it's not even talking about what happens on social media. So this is, I'm not telling you what to do, but I want you just to hear this. If the developers of the technology are not giving it to their kids, and they're restricting their own usage, treating themselves as if they're children, I need help, I need you to make it so I can't do this, then we, as the church, must think long and hard about the decisions we make as parents. Because Scripture teaches us, Steve Jobs doesn't sit under this, but it teaches us that I, John Kidd, am responsible for what I put in front of my child, be it bread or be it a buffet that will lead to death. I want to introduce you to one last resource. This is a Christian resource called Harvest USA. They have a website with lots of resources on it. You can go to harvestusa.org. And they specialize in the area, I believe, of sexual addiction and helping people stay away from sexual addiction. They offer tools, videos that even tell you how to work with certain tools that are out there, like Covenant Eyes or Circle by Disney. They'll explain like how it works and what it can do to help you. I want you to watch this, and he's going to challenge us to pull the lens back a little bit from, instead of asking the question, how do I help my kid navigate Snapchat in a way that's healthy? That might be the wrong question that we need to ask the church. We need to go up higher and ask a bigger question.
The image of a kid in a candy store is a vivid image, and so is our obsession with our devices, porn, and the internet. The internet via our smartphone devices has become a major highway to porn, and oftentimes we as parents simply want to help our kids manage their devices well. But the concern for managing technology is asking how to rightly eat the candy in the store. I'm concerned, though, that we're not questioning the assumed pillars of our 21st century existence, the candy itself. More basic than the management of our devices is the worldview by which we live. As parents, along with the ways to help our children manage the internet and their devices, are we coming to terms with our own worldviews that often assume the normality of smart devices in our day and age? One of the goals of discipling our families is to help cultivate in them a superior love for Christ that will enable them to formulate worldviews which are radically oriented around the kingdom of God. So what's a more basic worldview question than what are the best filtering and accountability options to help us manage our devices? It's this. Is having the internet so close to us all the time facilitating our walk with Christ? For the child and the parent who is struggling with porn and tempted constantly, the answer is an emphatic no. But even if we and our children are not so engaged with porn, shouldn't we all be concerned with having such a potentially destructive force in our hands at all times? Because of our own weakness and the prevalence of porn, perhaps we need to question the accessibility of the web in our lives. What if we actually removed our capabilities to access the internet on some of our devices altogether? What if, through the use of filtering software, we implemented times throughout the day during which we can't even access the internet? But we should also think carefully about the role that smart technology plays in our lives. Perhaps the better question is not, how do I manage this device? But rather, should I even have this device? Before we rejoice that we're not like that guy over there looking at porn regularly on a smartphone, we need to also remember that we're more like that guy than we would often care to admit. It only takes one moment of weakness, and we are very weak. Instead of accepting the assumptions of our culture as normative, I want my children and myself to bring those assumptions into the light and ask hard questions of them. Are we helping our kids form worldviews that perceive the supremacy of God and Christ as the ultimate point of life? Or are we simply digesting the norms of our culture without thoughtfully vetting them through a Christ-centered worldview? As we start the new year, if we centered the discussion around our devotion to Christ and asked hard worldview questions of the pillars of our 21st century existence, we might stand out at restaurants as people who love others and aren't consumed with our screens. We might find a measure of sanity concerning porn. And most importantly, we might become more thoughtful, intentional, and devoted followers of our Lord.
That's challenging. It's challenging. one of the things I appreciate about Reformed theology is a very sober understanding of our depravity, our weakness. I hate the fact that I'm weak. I hate the fact that a little metal box can tempt me to sin in ways that will hurt my wife and children. I hate that I need help. But it's right for me to hate my sin all the more and to make choices in light of what does it mean to disciple myself and my kids and to make Christ great and to call into question healthily the norms of our culture. Last question at your tables. Question that's been out there. When do I give my kid a device? I want you to answer this. What do you see as the biggest challenge for delaying your child getting a smartphone particularly? Okay. Tablets aren't as cool and hip anymore. The smartphone is, I work with teens, that's primarily what they're going to want. And they might not even care if it's smart. They just want it to look like this. And they want to put it in their jean pocket and have it hang out 3/4 of an inch. you're going to wrestle with a angry conversation, a very emotional conversation, one that is connected to some of the deepest longings that your child has, and that's to be liked and loved and not seen as outside. And it's going to be connected to this device, which to them is just, I want to talk to my friends or whatever. And to you, from what you've heard today, you understand it's so much more than that. And there are millions of dollars and really smart people trying to make it more than that for your child. And you're not going to see eye to eye with your kid. What are some of the biggest challenges that you see in delaying your child having the phone? Because they're going to ask for it if they're in public school in 4th grade, 5th grade, 6th grade. Every year that you're not giving it to them, they're going to ask for it, and it's going to be a battle. And I'm suggesting you delay that beyond kindergarten. I'm suggesting that you delay that, but it's going to come at a cost. Talk about that cost. So the takeaway that as parents who desire to intentionally shepherd our homes in the area of technology, when it comes down particularly to the cell phone, I want you to hopefully say, okay, now at least for 5 minutes I've thought about what does it mean to step back one step and to ask a worldview question as opposed to everybody's doing this, therefore I have to figure out how to wade in that and help my kid manage the norm in a way that's safe. Because I do think when I come backwards a little bit and I start to think bigger picture, it helps me see some of the idiosyncrasies in my logic or breakdowns in my thinking pattern. So I wanted you to do that. Kids are going to have devices. Many of your children already have devices. So the last thing I would say on this subject is if they have a device, and I would implore you to do hard work, which we don't like hard work, but to do the hard work to help them help them by protecting their device. That's going to be you having to do research. That's going to be you having to spend money. It's going to be you having to hold their device. It's going to be difficult, emotionally charged, fighting conversations with your children. So things like filters or VPNs on your home networks, blocking out certain apps, locking down their phones so you have permission to add and delete apps, monitoring what they're using, which is really difficult. Just FYI, students are generally smarter than you are when it comes to using these apps. So most children will delete all their chat history before they get home, knowing that parents will look at chat history or Instagram photos that have been sketchy throughout the day. They can just take those down. That's going to be part of the conversation. But I would argue, and most research would argue, that your child's device, there's no health and no wisdom in your child's device being their personal private property. That is your property. Most likely, you're going to have bought it. If they're living under your home, you declare it yours, even if they paid for it. But it is not a place that they have rights to privacy. You can argue with me about that later. Their personal journal, that's private. But as we've understood, there's nothing private, as much as you might like to think about my Facebook feed being private. No, it's not private. My Instagram, not private. My chat's not private. That's property that is owned by those companies. It should be owned by you as the parent. So we're going to wrap this up. I'm going to talk a little about application and a few just ideas. One thing I really appreciate about this book that's on your table, he's way more positive than I am, by the way. That's why I'm giving you the book. But today I just wanted to shake you up a little bit. But he says, technology promises to make life easy. But life in the family wasn't meant to be easy. There are good things in this world, and they're only good because they're really hard. But technology is most often trying to cut the corner of the hard or take the edge off the pain or to circumvent the process. And we have to ask ourselves the questions, how do I make my family, how do I make the bedroom, the dinner table, the living room, the kitchen, places where God-honoring, life-giving interactions are happening and they're taking place regularly? As Christian parents called to shepherd our children, we're called to pursue and engage the hard things and to move away from easy and fast and convenient. Listen again to Proverbs chapter 8, verses 34 through 36. It says, blessed is the one who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting beside my doors. There's an eagerness for this wisdom. For whoever finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who fails to find me injures himself. And all who hate me love death. This is a wisdom issue. It's not black and white. It's not clear as to what sin is. Lisa asked me the other day, she said, so when is a kid ready for a phone? and I don't think it's going to be the same answer for every child. If a child's like me, they're never going to be ready because I am ill-equipped to handle unfettered, anonymous internet access all the time. I don't have that maturity. Some of you have children who are already interacting with devices. I want to throw a slide up behind me. This is from one of the psychologists in Glow Kids saying, does my kid have a problem? Okay. We haven't talked a ton about addiction. There's lots written about addiction. But these are a few questions to ask that might tip you off to say, maybe I have a problem, and maybe my children have a problem. Are they staying up later and later on their device? I hear this all the time from the youth in our church, staying up till 2 in the morning. What are you doing? Are you doing homework? Well, no, I'm texting to my friend who's suicidal, and they need me to talk them down. Then they're exhausted the next day, and so it goes on. Does your child get fidgety, anxious, or angry if they don't have their device? There's lots of research now on the aggression levels of young people connected to whether or not they are either with their device, which has become, we had blankies, they have their cell phones, okay? So there's an agitation, an insecurity, a fear that comes with the absence of that device or their video game unit. Is their tech usage negatively impacting their schoolwork or family interactions? What I didn't show you from the CNN, being 13, was I had it, but I have too much to say, was an interview with some kids talking about how many times they checked their social media during the school day. Like averages were in like the 50 range up to 200 times a day. And they're checking it for different reasons than you're checking it. They're checking it to see if somebody else has posted something about them so that they can refute it. So, because they can stand up for themselves. They're checking it because that's a good time for them to keep up their snap streak, their Snapchat streaks. Are you familiar with that? Something Snapchat created specifically to keep people on Snapchat. So if I Snapchat with you 5 days in a row, our streak is 5 days, okay? It's pretty cool to have Snapchat streaks that are like 300, 400 days, and to have 10, 20, 30 streaks going at a time. That takes a lot of time, so I'm going to do that while I'm at school. So these kids were motivated to be looking at their devices in class, in between class, after class, on the bus. It's pretty distracting. How about, is your child hiding their screen usage or hiding their device from you? I could talk about that one a lot. Does your child seem more apathetic or bored? So here's where the truth is out, in the sense that you cannot stop your children from having access to the internet. You cannot prohibit your child from seeing pornography. You cannot prohibit them from engaging in these things. But there's a really important value in the fact that in your relationship with your child, you have set these parameters, and it's expressed when you do so that this is because I love you and care for you, and this is why I'm putting these boundaries on you. So that when they choose to go outside of those boundaries and receive a device from a friend, they understand that it is outside of the parameters of what you have said is healthy and good and God-honoring in their life. So it's like they're crossing over that line. And now they're in charted territory where they understand something's different about this space where I'm stealing a device from a friend versus this space where I'm in the bounds of what I'm honoring my parents because this is what they've set for me. And just that line in the sand, those parameters, them moving in and out of that, is God uses that to help them understand what is true and reinforce your care for them, and hopefully reinforce the goodness of the gospel. So, but you're right. They're going to find it, get it, see it. But it does matter. That doesn't mean we throw our hands up. It does matter how we set those parameters and how we care for them, particularly when they're thinking about it 5 years later. That's a really good question. Lastly, does your child seem perpetually tired yet also wired? So this has to do with some of the cognitive dissonance that's happening in their brains as their brains are developing. And there's tons written on the neuroscience, which I know nothing about, but I enjoy reading. That's also in Glow Kids as well as some of the other books. So if these things are true of your kid, I think I would at least ask you to say, wow, maybe we should talk to somebody. Maybe I need to be more intentional with my child, either with those parameters or my conversations with him, or we might actually need to get help for our child. Interesting quote from a guy named, I believe it's Johann Hari, who has a couple TED Talks on addiction. He says, the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. Okay? So children are often moving towards addictions because they're lacking in life-giving, healthy, robust relationship. And so, everything we're talking about now with technology is irrelevant. If you didn't listen to Lisa earlier, and you're thinking about what does it look like to make relational connections, to build trust and rapport, and to push into those hard conversations with my kids when they're in the home, because that is what's leading your child to go to their bedroom, to hide, to look at porn at 2 a.m. That's what's leading your child to go and try to unhelpfully enable other people by caring for them when they're suicidal on just chatting. They're wanting connection. They're wanting relationship. So as you leave, I want you to have a resource, at least one in your hand, and that is the book that's on your table. That is a gift for you. This book has been out for, just over a year or two. I have lots of different books that I'd like to give you. I like this one because it's small, thin, and it's well written. It's not kind of a the sky is falling book, kind of like maybe how I've come across today. But it's written from a family's perspective on some things that they've been trying to do in their family in real time to set right boundaries, to care well, to shepherd well in the area of technology. But I will tell you this, in the introduction, I think he uses the language, some of the things I'm going to say are radical. Lisa mentioned we're swimming upstream. We want you to be countercultural. And I'll just be honest with you, that stinks to be countercultural, particularly as a parent. But he is going to suggest things like delaying giving your child a phone, having hard conversations with them, trying to help them put on lenses so they can see their peers and their culture and start to see, wait, this is damaging to the social structures at our school. Wait, I can see that my friend's depressed, but I also see how their use of their phone is feeding that depression and how when they feel low, they go straight to it. And then I watch her check out for 20 minutes, like help them see what is going on. And then they're going to start to grow and say, I don't want that. That's not good for you, friend. Let me help you. Yes, parent, I receive your boundaries because I understand why. The beauty that you guys have now that didn't exist 6 months ago is article after article, book after book written saying what you're trying to do right here is good and healthy. Sadly, right now, the school system is against you on this one. And that's not going to change for quite some time, I don't believe. There's really interesting things to read about that. So your child may have a Chromebook at school, but you can put in their mind right ideas about how to use that Chromebook in school. You can ask them questions about how they engage it in the classroom. In what ways is it really helping you learn? What are ways you can be creative with it? How do you see it distracting you and your peers? What's it look like for you to shut that Chromebook and listen to the teacher? What's it look like for you to stop chatting on that Chromebook with your friends and listen to a lesson? And when those Chromebooks come home, again, it's in your household. You're the boss of how that device is used. And I think that you guys, I'm going to wrestle with this tension of how many decisions do I make that make my child different versus how many decisions do I make that allow them to be more mainstream but protect them and care for them. And that's, we're in murky waters, and those are hard decisions. But there are options, and I don't want to talk forever. Okay, lastly, or second to last, let me think. He's also going to suggest that you don't ever allow devices in the bedroom overnight. I would just say one word to that, brilliant and necessary. And I will challenge you parents to consider that same rule for yourself. One of the wisest things somebody said to me when I was in premarital was, I would suggest, it can't be dogmatic about this, it's not a sin issue, but don't put a TV in your bedroom. Some of you may have TVs. Kelly and I have never had a TV in our bedroom. And it's been really healthy for our communication and romance. He's also going to suggest that you keep devices away from the dinner table. He's going to say 1 hour a day, device-free, 1 day a week, device-free, and 1 week a year, device-free. So he's saying no devices at dinner, no devices on the Sabbath, and no devices on vacation. Can you believe that? That's what he's going to challenge you to consider. And then he's going to say, you need to protect and limit any device that is in your home, in your family. No device is private. There's no such thing as privacy for a child when it comes to a smartphone or device. So it's a really good and short book. It's helpful. We paid for it. You read it. It's a gift to you. And again, I would encourage you to discuss it with one another. I've been really encouraged to hear the back and forth that's happened at these tables. Like Lisa said, it's so hard for a child to feel like I'm the only one. My parents are so lame because they don't let me have a phone or whatever. But so much better for their other friend to be like, yeah, our parents are so lame because they don't let us have a phone. Okay? It's a big difference. They're going to still think you're foolish or against them. But if they're not alone, that makes all the difference. And when you don't feel alone, when I don't feel like I'm the only parent trying to like make these really weird decisions, that helps me pursue what I believe is right. And we're going to come to different conclusions, but we can still encourage one another. If you have a child in youth group, starting tomorrow and for 3 weeks, I'm teaching the youth a three-part series on technology. So some of your kids come regularly, some of they don't. If you care about this subject and them and you want them to hear from a source other than you about why they need to be careful navigating these things, I'm happy to be the whipping post. And so I'm teaching for 3 weeks. Please encourage your youth to come to youth group for this. Primarily, because I think it'll be great when they get home. You came here, they went there, and you guys can have conversations. So I want to enable you to open up these conversations and have windows for growth. I want to leave you with the good news. God is good, and gracious. I can have the disposition where the sky is falling on lots of different fronts. This is just one of them. Even if the sky is falling, because God never promises that we're going to have stability. He never promises that culture is going to be for us. But even in those situations, he's good and he's gracious and he gives us what we need. He promises to give wisdom for those who ask. So I would implore you to pray for wisdom. He's not surprised by the challenge. He's not surprised that we, you know, made homosexual marriage legal in this country. He's not surprised at the gender fluidity conversation that's happening. He's well aware of it. And he equips us as we step out in faith by his Spirit. And he's called us to do it together. So if you're doing it alone, that's outside of how God's designed it for you. He wants us to do this conversation together. As Lisa said earlier, we failed, but we've been forgiven. And we can move forward in confidence. Let me pray, and you guys are free to leave. God, thanks so much for this morning. Thanks for the opportunity to wrestle with these issues alongside of other parents. Thank you that you've put us on the same team as the church, that you've called us to walk through these things together, that you have not left us alone. You've given us your Spirit, and you've also given us one another. Lord, it's my inclination to reject those helps and to do it myself. Lord, I pray that you would call us to wisdom and to obedience, that we might lean on you and each other to understand that we are needy and our children are no different. Give us wisdom as we seek to care for them and shepherd them. Give us patience as we navigate very difficult conversations with our kids. Would you, by your grace and mercy, allow our youth and young ones to receive truth from us, that your Spirit would enlighten them to say, this is good for me, even when all of their friends are doing something different. We beg you for help in that way. Thank you for your word and how you do not leave us to make up these truths on our own or to try to figure them out, but you've told us clearly that we need wisdom, that we should be discerning, that we should rest in your sovereignty, yet we have responsibility. Thank you for your word and how it teaches us those things. We love our kids. We love you. We're so grateful you've called us to be your children in Christ. Amen.